A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A leak develops in the roof over a bed. A couple tells the landlord. The leak spreads. Asthma kicks in. They drag a 6-month-old baby to the couch, then to a relative's apartment. And when the landlord finally shows up, he says into a recording device that yes, he'll fix it. The next morning, he emails them an eviction notice. That's the story Daniel sent us.
That story isn't just a bad week. In this market, an eviction is a catastrophe. Jerusalem's vacancy rate is under 2% right now. Rents are up 18% since 2023, and wages haven't come close to keeping pace. When you lose a rental here, you're not just apartment hunting, you're fighting for shelter in a market that has none to spare.
This isn't really a landlord horror story, though it is that. It's a case study in what happens when housing instability gets inside your head and rewires how you feel about safety, about trust, about whether the world will catch you when you fall. Daniel's question isn't, was my landlord bad? It's, did this break something in me, and how do I put it back?
Let's trace the actual sequence, because the order of events matters. Daniel and his wife have been renting in Israel for a decade. Their first apartment together. The landlord decides to give it to a family member. That's legal here, by the way. 60 to 90 days notice, and you're out. They absorb that hit, they move to a new place in central Jerusalem, they settle in. Then one day, a leak appears in the roof, right over their bed.
Which is already a particular kind of violation. Your bed is the one place in a home where you're supposed to be safe and unconscious, water dripping on it from above. That's almost mythologically bad.
It gets worse in a straight line. They tell the landlord. He deflects. Blames the neighbors, the building committee, anyone but himself. The leak spreads. Daniel's asthma, which had been managed, comes roaring back. Now, they're not just uncomfortable. They're medically compromised, with a 6-month-old in the apartment.
They do the only thing they can. They abandon the bedroom. Then a relative's empty apartment. They're displaced inside their own home, then displaced from it entirely. All while the baby needs feeding and changing, and the landlord is still dodging responsibility.
Then comes the moment that makes this story different from a simple neglect case. The landlord finally shows up. Daniel records the conversation. Perfectly legal in Israel. One-party consent jurisdiction. And on that recording, the landlord commits to fixing the leak. Verbal commitment captured. Next morning, an email arrives. It's hostile, it's accusatory, and it terminates their tenancy.
That's the knife twist. He didn't just fail to fix the roof. He used the tenant's own documentation posture against them. The recording, which was supposed to be protection, became the trigger for retaliation. Next day, eviction.
Now they're in a market with sub 2% vacancy, an infant, no family nearby for childcare, scrambling to find shelter before the clock runs out. They manage it. But the moving process is a week of backbreaking labor they can't afford to outsource. No rent reduction ever materialized. When they told the landlord the bedroom was uninhabitable, his response was, and I'm quoting Daniel here, well, you can just leave.
You can just leave. Spoken by a man who owns multiple properties to a family with a baby and nowhere to go. That's not negligence anymore. That's the structural contempt of someone who knows he faces no consequences.
Here's where Daniel's question gets serious. He says he feels, quote, profoundly disappointed in the human condition. He says the sadness has stuck with him, embedded itself. He asks whether this is trauma, or whether that sounds melodramatic. And I want to sit with that question directly, because it's not rhetorical. Is this trauma, or just a very bad rental experience?
I think that's the right framing. Not did this qualify for a diagnosis, but what did it do to him, and why hasn't it faded the way it faded for his wife?
To answer that, we need to look at the legal machinery underneath this story, because what happened to Daniel isn't just bad luck with a bad landlord, it's what the system is designed to produce.
Walk me through it. What's the actual law that let this guy terminate a tenancy the day after promising to fix a roof?
The Tenant Protection Law, originally 1954, amended most recently in 2017. Under Israeli law, a landlord can end a tenancy with 60 to 90 days notice for something called personal need. That phrase covers a lot of ground, giving the apartment to a family member wanting to sell, wanting to move back in. The tenant has no right to challenge whether the claim is genuine and no right to renew.
Personal need is the legal escape hatch that turns any tenancy into a temporary arrangement, regardless of how long you've lived there.
And Daniel had already been through this once before. His first landlord gave the apartment to a family member. He absorbed the cost and moved. Now it's happening again, but this time the personal need claim arrives 24 hours after he records the landlord committing to repairs. That timing isn't a coincidence.
Which brings us to the habitability side. The same law that lets landlords terminate at will also says they have to maintain the property, right?
Section 6 of the Tenant Protection Law. Landlords must keep the property in habitable condition. Mold that triggers asthma and forces a family to abandon the bedroom? That's a textbook habitability violation, but here's where the mechanism breaks. To enforce it, the tenant has to file a claim, small claims court, or the rent tribunal. That process takes 3 to 6 months, and during those months, the tenant must keep paying full rent. If they withhold rent, even for an uninhabitable unit, they can be evicted for non-payment.
The law says the landlord has to fix the mold, but the enforcement timeline is 6 months. And during those 6 months, you're still paying full rent for a bedroom you can't use. That's not a remedy. That's a hostage situation.
It gets worse. The Israel Democracy Institute published a study in 2024 that tracked what happens when tenants actually file habitability complaints. 67% of tenants who filed formal complaints received eviction notices within 90 days. Among tenants who didn't complain?
You're telling me that asserting your legal right to a habitable home makes you more than 5 times likelier to be evicted than staying quiet.
That's exactly what the data shows. The system punishes assertion of rights, and landlords know this. Why fix a roof when you can just terminate the tenancy and re-rent at a higher price in a market with sub 2% vacancy? The incentive structure is perverse.
Which brings us to the recording. Daniel did what any reasonable person would do. He documented the landlord's verbal commitment. Israel's a one-party consent jurisdiction. Supreme Court ruling HCJ 123/04. So the recording was perfectly legal. He had proof. And the landlord responded by emailing an eviction notice the next morning.
This is what I've started calling the recording paradox. You record to protect yourself. But the act of documentation signals to the landlord that you're building a case. And a landlord who owns multiple properties, who faces no real scarcity, who knows the tribunal timeline is 6 months, his rational response isn't to fix the leak. It's to remove the tenant who's gathering evidence.
The recording didn't fail because it was inadmissible. It failed because it changed the landlord's calculus from ignore the problem to eliminate the complainer.
Compare this to a jurisdiction that actually works. In Germany, under BGB Section 536, if a leak makes a room uninhabitable, the landlord has 48 hours to fix it. If they don't, the tenant can reduce rent by up to 100% for that room. Immediately, no court filing required. The burden is on the landlord to challenge the reduction, not on the tenant to beg for enforcement.
What's the Israeli equivalent of that timeline?
There isn't one. No statutory deadline. The courts have interpreted reasonable time as somewhere between 14 and 30 days. So in Germany, 48 hours. In Israel, 2 weeks minimum, and that's only after you file. Meanwhile, the mold is spreading and your asthmatic lungs are reacting and your six-month-old is sleeping on a relative's couch.
The legal architecture here does 3 things simultaneously. It gives landlords near unlimited power to terminate tenancies under personal need. It creates a habitability enforcement process so slow that compliance is optional. And it punishes tenants who try to use the tools the law theoretically provides. That's not a system with gaps. That's a system that works exactly as intended for the people it's intended to work for.
The landlord's line, you can just leave. That's not cruelty for its own sake. That's the voice of someone who understands the architecture perfectly. He knows the vacancy rate. He knows the tribunal timeline. He knows he can re-rent the unit the day Daniel moves out, probably for more money. You can just leave, is the system speaking through the landlord's mouth.
The law failed, but the law isn't the only thing that broke. Let's talk about what happened inside Daniel's head. Because the question he's actually asking isn't about tribunal timelines. It's about whether this rewired him.
The research says yes, it very likely did. There's a 2023 meta-analysis in the Journal of Traumatic Stress that looked at involuntary displacement. People forced from their homes through eviction, foreclosure, uninhabitable conditions. 31% of adults met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD. That's comparable to rates after physical assault.
31%. A third of people who go through something like this end up with symptoms that look like what you'd see after a violent attack. That's not melodrama. That's neurobiology.
The mechanism is specific. Housing displacement activates the same neural pathways as betrayal trauma. Your shelter, the place your brain has mapped as safe, as baseline, as the environment where threat is lowest, becomes the source of threat. The amygdala fires danger signals. The anterior cingulate cortex, which handles conflict detection, lights up because the world isn't matching your mental model of how shelter is supposed to work. The roof over your bed is supposed to protect you. It's dripping mold onto your pillow instead. That's a betrayal at the level of the brainstem.
Daniel's emotional arc maps this perfectly. He describes going from initial concern, there's a leak, tell the landlord, to frustration when nothing happens, to panic when the mold triggers his asthma and they're on the couch, to sadness, and finally to what he calls profound disappointment in the human condition. That's not a random sequence. That's a classic betrayal trauma arc.
The disappointment in the human condition piece is particularly telling. That's not anger at one bad actor, that's a shattered assumption about how the world works. When you believe, even implicitly, that the system will eventually catch you, that if you're reasonable and document everything and follow the rules, things will work out. And then the system doesn't just fail you, but punishes you for trying. The collapse isn't just practical. It's existential.
Which is where the degradation spiral comes in. Daniel uses the word degraded. Not inconvenienced, not frustrated. Something was taken from him that wasn't just shelter.
This maps to a concept you see in the clinical literature called learned helplessness, Seligman's work from 1972. When repeated attempts to assert control over a situation fail, the brain eventually stops trying. Tell the landlord about the leak, it gets worse. Record his commitment to repair, you get evicted. Seek a legal remedy. The timeline is 6 months and you're paying full rent the whole time. Each attempt to assert your rights produces a worse outcome. The rational response from the brain is to stop asserting.
The degradation isn't just emotional. It's a learned response to a system that punishes agency. You're trained, through repeated negative reinforcement, to expect that trying to protect yourself will backfire. That's the opposite of empowerment.
Then there's the contrast with his wife. Daniel says she bounces back faster, focuses on logistics, seems less stuck in the sadness. The research actually explains this pretty well. Pragmatic coping, focusing on concrete tasks, finding the next apartment, managing the move, reduces cortisol faster than rumination. It's effective in the short term, but it can also suppress processing. You get through the crisis, but the emotional reckoning gets deferred.
Neither response is better. His wife's pragmatism got them housed. Daniel's rumination is getting him to ask questions about what this did to him. Different strategies, different timelines, different trade-offs.
We haven't even talked about the baby, 6 months old. Daniel says his son couldn't understand what was happening cognitively, and he's right. But that doesn't mean he wasn't affected. A 2022 study in child development found that parental housing insecurity predicts elevated cortisol in infants, even when the infant has no cognitive understanding of the situation. The stress isn't transmitted through explanation. It's transmitted through the parent's chronic stress state, tone of voice, disrupted routines, the absence of calm in the home.
The baby wasn't traumatized by the leak. He was traumatized by watching his parents be traumatized. That's a heavy thing to sit with.
And it connects to the class dimension Daniel gestures at. The landlord owns multiple properties. He told Daniel, "You can just leave." That line only works because of the power asymmetry. The landlord faces no scarcity. He has other units, other income streams. Daniel faces a 2% vacancy market with an infant and no family child care. The degradation is structural, built into the gap between those two positions. But it feels deeply personal because it lands on your body, in your bedroom, while your child sleeps in the next room.
That's the thing about structural contempt. It's delivered through individual interactions. A landlord's dismissive email, you can just leave. So it registers as personal cruelty, but the cruelty is downstream of the power arrangement. The landlord doesn't have to be a sadist. He just has to act in his rational self-interest within a system that imposes no costs on him for doing so.
That's exactly why it sticks. If it were just one bad man, you could write it off. But Daniel's been through this before. The first landlord giving the apartment to a family member, the toilet removal landlord he mentions in passing. The pattern teaches something. It teaches that the system is the threat, and individual landlords are just its agents. That's a harder thing to recover from than one bad interaction.
When Daniel asks whether this created trauma, the feeling of being summarily disempowered and degraded, with no immediate remedy from society, the answer isn't ambiguous. That's exactly what it did. The research backs him. The mechanism is clear. The question isn't whether the wound is real. It's how you heal when the thing that wounded you is still in place.
What do you actually do with all of this? Because sitting in the wreckage and understanding why it wrecked you, that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Daniel asked how you build yourself back. And there are things that actually work.
Give me the first one. Something someone listening could do tomorrow.
Document everything, but strategically, not confrontationally. Record conversations, date stamp photos of damage, save every email. But here's the recording paradox in practice. Evidence is only power if you have a legal strategy, not just proof. Don't hand your documentation to the landlord as a threat. Send it to a lawyer, or even just a level-headed friend who can hold it for you. The goal is to have the file ready when you need it, without triggering the retaliation that comes from signaling you're building a case.
Document in silence. Build the file without brandishing it. That makes sense. It keeps your options open without painting a target on your back.
Second one, and this is something most tenants in Israel don't know exists. Under the Takanat Seder Hadin from 2019, you can petition the rent tribunal for an emergency repair order. If granted, it compels the landlord to fix hazards within 7 days. 7 days, not 6 months. Most tenants never file because they don't know the mechanism exists. But it's there, and it changes the timeline entirely.
7 days versus 6 months is the difference between a remedy and a joke.
If the landlord won't fix a habitability issue, you can deposit your rent with the court instead of paying the landlord directly. The money sits there until the repair is made. This forces the landlord to act because they're not getting paid until they do, but you're protected from eviction for non-payment because the court holds the funds. It's a pressure valve that most tenants don't know they have.
There are tools, obscure ones, but real ones. That's the legal side. What about the psychological rebuild? Because Daniel's not just asking how to fight a landlord. He's asking how to stop feeling degraded.
The research on post-traumatic growth, this is Tedeschi and Calhoun, 2004, shows something counterintuitive. People who actively make meaning from the experience recover faster than those who just try to move on. Journaling about what you learned, sharing the story. Advocating for policy change. The people who stay stuck are the ones who treat it like a bad dream to be forgotten. The people who heal are the ones who turn it into something.
Which means Daniel writing this prompt, laying out the whole sequence, naming the degradation, asking whether it's trauma. That's not wallowing. That's recovery behavior. He's doing the thing the research says works.
And the broader point is this. The degradation he felt is real, but it's not permanent and it's not personal. The system is designed to produce exactly that feeling, powerlessness, smallness, the sense that trying makes it worse. Recognizing that as systemic rather than personal is the first step to reclaiming agency. The landlord wasn't targeting Daniel because of who Daniel is. He was targeting him because of what Daniel represented, a tenant asserting rights in a structure that punishes assertion.
The rebuild isn't about forgetting what happened. It's about understanding that what happened wasn't a verdict on you. It was the system functioning as designed, and you got caught in the gears.
You can rebuild. But the bigger question is whether you should have to. Daniel asked how to put himself back together, and we've given him some tools. But the deeper problem is that the system demands individual resilience to survive something the system itself inflicts. That's not a bug. That's the design.
Which is why I keep coming back to something happening right now in the Knesset. Amendment 12 to the Tenant Protection Law. It's under debate as of last month, and it would create what they're calling a right to repair. Tenants could deduct repair costs from rent directly. No court approval, no 6-month wait. If a landlord won't fix a leak, you fix it yourself and subtract the bill from next month's payment.
That would fundamentally flip the power dynamic. Right now, the landlord holds all the leverage because the enforcement timeline is so long that compliance is optional. If tenants can act immediately and deduct costs, the calculus changes. Suddenly, ignoring a leak costs the landlord money, real money, immediately, instead of costing the tenant health and shelter.
It's not passed yet, and there will be opposition. There always is when you try to shift power from property owners to the people living in the property. But the fact that it's even being debated means the conversation is shifting. The assumption that tenants should just absorb degradation as the price of renting, that assumption is cracking.
That's the note I want to leave this on. Daniel's son was 6 months old when all this happened. He won't remember the leak, or the mold, or the frantic apartment search. But he'll grow up knowing something about his parents. He'll know they didn't just take it. They documented, they fought, they asked hard questions about what it did to them. That's the legacy that outlasts any landlord's eviction notice.
The system can change. It changes when enough people stop treating degradation as normal and start treating it as what it is. A structural failure that demands a structural answer. Daniel's prompt is part of that. So is every tenant who learns about emergency repair orders and rent escrow and uses them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 14th century Florence, the Wool Guild required master candidates to present a masterpiece, judged by guild elders while blindfolded, not to test the work's quality, but to prove the candidate could identify his own creation by touch alone. Only one surviving guild statute, from the Dyer's Guild of Lucca in 1388, records the blindfold requirement in writing.
A lot of faith in tactile memory.
I have follow-up questions about sweaty wool and dye-stained fingers, but I'm going to sit with them quietly.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own question, rental horror stories, blindfolded guild rituals, or anything in between, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We're on a brief break after this one, so take your time with the next prompt. We'll be back before you know it.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.